KALW.
They are wild animals, so even though they're sick and injured and cute, we try to approach them as we would a wild animal.
While the Bay Area shelters in place, some vets are still working to give sea lions the care they need. We're going behind the scenes at the Marine Mammal Center. Then we answer a question that came to us from a listener like you.
Why does San Francisco have the Farallon Islands or the Farallon Islands? They're 30 miles off the coast, but they're legally part of San Francisco. What's up with that?
And we continue our tour of Golden Gate Park in celebration of its 150th anniversary.
Swing dancing is really particularly good for me because it's a happy, happy dance.
I'm Henna Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The Bay Area is sheltering in place for the third day. A lot of activity has stopped, but some things go on no matter what. Tonight is the vernal equinox, the start of spring, and we're dedicating today's show to a celebration of nature and renewal. We're starting today's show with a story about women empowerment. Women are underrepresented in many scientific fields, but there's one branch of biological science that bucks that trend, veterinary science. Women now make up the majority of veterinarians in the country. They fill close to 80% of the seats in veterinary schools. The Marine Mammal Center in the Marin Headlands is a good example of this trend. The center is a combination emergency hospital, rehab center, and research institute for animals like seals, sea lions, sea otters, whales, dolphins, among other sea creatures. Three quarters of its paid staff and volunteer community are women. In this story from our archives, KALW's Jen Chien went for a visit.
It's a sunny day at the Marine Mammal Center. The animal pen area is bustling. Seals and sea lions are housed here, one, two, or three at a time, in individual chain link enclosures, each one containing its own small concrete pool. Outside one pen, a group of about five women are gathered around, getting their game plan together.
We're going to start with Boomer and F2, and then we're probably going to have to sneak out and go do Eloise, and then come back and do admits after.
That's Dr. Lorraine Barbosa. She's a veterinarian. Boomer is a young sea lion, about the size of a Labrador Retriever. He's hurt. He has cuts and gouges on several areas of his body.
Can you pull me some dry gauze off of the cart?
Barbosa squirts an orange liquid into the wounds. A volunteer restrains the sea lion in a kind of kneeling wrestler's stance, straddling the young animal while holding its head firmly against the ground. Most people here, interns, volunteers, vet techs, are well-trained in restraining their charges.
We're very careful with these guys because they are wild animals, so even though they're sick and injured and cute, we try to approach them as we would a wild animal because they can be potentially dangerous in terms of biting us.
Women make up the bulk of the workforce here. At any given time, there may be 80 to 100 people at the center, showing school groups and visitors around, doing administrative or research work, or caring for the animals.
We're just going to get everybody in, throw in the fish.
Part of that care is keeping these wild animals from getting too used to humans. All around the pen area, stacks of flat wooden boards with metal handles lean against the fences. People hold these boards in front of their bodies like shields as they approach the animals. Once one has been cornered, a wet towel gets wrapped around its head as a temporary blindfold slash muzzle. Then they go down all in one motion into that wrestler's stance.
And then can you pass me some more gauze?
But it doesn't always go smoothly.
Please. Oh, are you okay?
One of the vet interns trying to look at Boomer's teeth has gotten a bite on her thumb. She goes off to clean her own wound while the rest of the crew finishes up Boomer's exam.
Is it warm?
No.
Satisfied with Boomer's progress, the team lets him go and retreats from the pen. Barbosa started here as an intern herself while she was still in vet school. She says there are a lot of similarities between the two kinds of work.
I go and use skills I've learned here on mean yappy chihuahuas back in my small animal practice because I'm like, oh, that's a great way. We restrain them with towels too. Usually not wet towels, but, you know, similar. Yeah, I love it. I feel like I have the best of both worlds.
So it's a great way of combining, I think, thinking about science. Is it combines science with a concern for animal welfare. You know, so we're mixing those two different passions and interests.
That's Dr. Frances Gulland. About 20 years ago, the center was looking for a vet to develop a research program around its animal care.
I thought I'd come here for a year and earn enough money to buy a truck and drive to Alaska. And instead, 20 years later, I'm here, still here, and there's just always more research to do.
She's working on several big ongoing projects, including looking at the effects of harmful algae blooms on marine mammal health and the prevalence of cancer in California sea lions. Still, Gulland says that veterinary medicine is often dismissed by those in so-called hard science.
I think there's a perception that, and that's what I sort of received as a child, that you're basically, you know, looking after dogs, and that's sort of cute and it's nice, but it's not science. But if you think about it, to repair a fracture involves understanding how bones heal. If you're trying to treat, you know, gastrointestinal disease, you have to understand how the intestines respond to infections and how inflammation works.
Veterinary medicine used to be a male-dominated field, but Gulland's seen a lot of change over the course of her career.
First of all, veterinary school when I was there was mostly men, but now within the vet schools, the majority of vet students are female. And then within the marine mammal community, all the older scientists were male. And now if you go to a conference of marine mammal scientists, it's probably mostly women, even though there's still some of the senior positions are still mostly male. But there's definitely a change.
So my thoughts are deciding between going ahead and getting her anesthetized now, doing some pre-op like cleaning and x-rays and stuff like that.
Dr. Lorraine Barbosa and her all-female crew have now moved into an exam room. They're preparing to put a sea lion named Eloise under anesthesia so they can check how she's healing from a flipper amputation.
So once you have it all set up, you're going to basically get it pretty nice and snug on there because you're trying to create a seal, right?
Once Eloise goes under, the crew snaps into quiet, efficient action, getting her quickly onto the table, placing a tube into her mouth, and preparing surgical instruments and medications.
Is she pretty deep? She looks like... I'm going to put her on two.
One of the women gathered around the operating table is Joelle Sweeney, who's in her last year of vet school. She started here as a volunteer.
It's a dream place for me, and I'd love to come back and work as well.
In the Marin Headlands, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in 2014. Since then, Dr. Frances Gulland moved on from the center to become Commissioner for Marine Mammals nationally. Lorraine Barbosa became part of the Oiled Wildlife Care Network at UC Davis, and Joelle Sweeney is now a veterinarian in Seattle, Washington. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, it's Hey Area, our crowdsourced journalism project where we find answers to the questions you ask. Britt Bird wanted to know,
why does San Francisco have the Farallon Islands or the Farallon Islands? They're 30 miles off the coast, but they're legally part of San Francisco. What's up with that?
KALW's Joshua Sirotiak went to find out.
Well, Britt, first off, I'm pretty sure it's Farallons. Don't worry, it's a tough word. They're these islands off the coast of San Francisco, and Britt noticed them on the internet.
I had a very boring job where I would just spend a lot of time on Google Maps a lot of times.
One day he was looking at San Francisco and noticed the county line jutting 30 miles out into the ocean and circling some tiny little dots.
And you go, wait a second, what is that?
Even on a clear day, you can just make out the islands from the city. They're like jagged teeth sticking out of the Pacific. To understand why they're part of San Francisco, you first have to understand what they're like. So I went to the visitor center for the Greater Farallones National Marine Sanctuary.
Head north on Merchant Road.
Okay. It's at Crissy Field in the Presidio.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, you found us!
Yeah, I got a little nervous coming down this access road here.
These days, the islands are protected as a national wildlife refuge, and only a handful of people get to set foot on them. One of those lucky people is Mary Jane Schramm. She's the sanctuary's public outreach specialist. Schramm says that out near the islands, deep ocean waters drift up to the surface.
Bringing all those nutrients up until, you know, the area just below the surface where sunlight can penetrate, and that just bursts into this tremendous productivity. It's like sunlight on your garden.
And what's growing in that garden, as in all gardens, is life. Lots of it. There's algae and plankton, and they attract fish. The fish attract seals, sea lions, birds, and even great white sharks. So the water around the islands provides food, and the islands themselves provide a place for the animals to breed and rest.
They function marvelously as a bed and breakfast.
Back in the day, all those animals attracted people. In the early 1800s, Russians started coming to the islands to hunt the seals and otters for meat, pelts, and blubber. Then, in the middle of the century, the gold rush began, and
all of a sudden, San Francisco went from nothing to being a big city.
This is Carl Nolte. He writes the Native Sun column for the San Francisco Chronicle about the area's history. He says that during the gold rush, there were so many people flooding into the area that there wasn't enough to eat. A pharmacist and his brother-in-law had an idea.
They didn't have any chickens or anything here, so they went out to the Farallones and raided them for eggs from the common murres.
One of the many seabirds that nest on the islands.
And sold them in the city for a dollar a piece. And a dollar in 1849 was like $50 now.
Actually, I checked. It's closer to $35. But you get the point. Word spread of how much money the two men had made, and others started going out to the islands to harvest eggs. Demand for the eggs was so great that competition turned violent. Historians call it the egg war. Now, eating these eggs doesn't sound too appetizing, at least to me. When it's cooked, the white remains translucent, but the yolk turns a bright red. But people ate them anyway. Nolte says there was even a famous dish called the Hangtown Fry. You can still get one today, but made with plain old chicken eggs.
You ever have one? It's not good for you. I mean, it's got eggs and bacon and oysters all squished up there and fried up. You don't eat two of them.
So when San Francisco went from a sleepy mission town to a booming gold rush city overnight, the population needed something to eat. The Farallones were where they found food, so it makes sense that they would be included within San Francisco's boundary. You could say it all boils down to basic economics. In San Francisco, I'm Joshua Sorodiak for CrossCurrents.
Joshua Sorotiak is a fellow in KALW's Audio Academy, class of 2020, and we're currently accepting applications for the next class, 2021. So if you want to learn how to make radio, become a better storyteller, and serve your community, find the application information at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. We're returning to the mainland now, to San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. It's preparing for a sesquicentennial, honoring 150 years as the city's sprawling backyard. There will be free events and concerts. And here at KALW, we're recognizing the park and its pleasures in our own way, with a podcast. Every Thursday, we drop a new episode of a walking journey from attraction to attraction. Last week, we discovered a hidden treasure, live jazz performed in a tunnel across from the Conservatory of Flowers. Today, we'll head west in this latest edition of the Golden Gate Parkcast. It's really lovely to spend time on a Sunday afternoon listening to jazz musicians play in the tunnel across from the Conservatory of Flowers. Now it's time to move on, though, to see what else we can find in the park. Let's continue our journey. This is the Golden Gate Parkcast from KALW Public Media. I'm your host, Hannah Baba. So we climb the steps up and out of the hollow and turn west along John F. Kennedy Drive. The flower garden before the conservatory is full of blooms and people lounging on the grass. A skateboarder cruises along in the bike lane. Confused tourists zoom by in yellow go-karts. On our right, we see a blacktop set amongst the trees. Several people are dancing, and they're on roller skates. This has been a Golden Gate Park tradition for decades. People get together here at the 6th Avenue Skate Park to show off their coordinated roller disco dance moves. After checking out the scene, it's a nice flat walk to our next stop, and we can just see it up ahead. We see a riot of movement, people moving around on the wide sidewalk and into the street. Then we start to hear the sounds. In San Francisco, you don't have to go to a stuffy nightclub or a formal classroom to learn how to swing dance. If you want to learn the Lindy Hop, you can learn in the great outdoors. Reporter Carolina Hidalgo, who's originally from Chile, she was surprised to find the group called Lindy in the Park dancing in full daylight on one of her walks in Golden Gate Park.
At the corner of Hagiwara Tea Garden Drive and JFK, where taxis and tour buses turn toward the Dion and Academy of Sciences, more than 100 men and women are gathered around the source. But they are not just standing. They are dancing. Or at least they are trying to.
Nice.
Trish Richman is a regular.
I first came to Lindy in the Park probably almost 6 years ago.
She's got dancing in her blood.
My father was a swing dancer back in the 40s, and we used to dance in the house after dinner, and I never thought about it, but all this music is my music that I grew up with. A friend of mine mentioned that there was a group of people dancing in the park, and he walked me by here, and that was it. I never stopped.
Richman and I are standing with others in a circle, surrounding all kinds of dancers, all kinds of people. Casual parkgoers in shorts and t-shirts, serious dancers in sporty clothes, one guy with tattoos and piercings all over his body, and he's very, very good. All the old ladies want to dance with him.
And we wanted to keep it friendly and accessible to everyone.
That's Ken Watanabe, the Lindy in the Park co-founder, not the actor.
We started teaching a free lesson about 7 years ago, and that's helped a lot too. People can try it out and see if they like it, and usually they do.
I'm not so sure. Back home in Chile, I love to dance, but in nightclubs or at friends' houses, and probably with a cocktail in my hand. These people are in a park, in public, in the sunshine. But I decide to give it a try.
Okay. All right, let's try it. With the word.
I join a big group on the dance floor. We try to follow the steps Watanabe and his partner are showing us.
Again. One more. Here we go. Face up.
I feel ridiculous, and I feel like I should just get back in the circle of people watching. But then I look at the other students, all trying, some of them failing, all having fun. And I realize, this is good.
Swing dancing is really particularly good for me because it's a happy, happy dance.
Dance partners swing each other around. They throw each other up in the air. They smile and laugh.
You can't be depressed even if you're depressed when you got there. You're not depressed after one song. It's happy music and very energetic, so it's good for your spirit and your body.
Still, for self-conscious people like me, and for Richman's partner, it requires a leap of good-natured faith to get on the floor.
My partner and I have been together for 12 years, and he was very encouraging to me, but he said, no, I'm never going to do this. I'll stand there and watch you. He was nervous to try, but now he's as committed as I am, if not more. He loves it.
After dancing Lindy in the Park for a few songs, the draw is clear. It brings people together. There is something freeing about it.
I think that with this dance, maybe with all dances, but with partner dancings, they really are a connection with another person. So if you work on a computer all day long and you don't connect, this is however long a song is, a minute and a half, you are connected with your partner.
Ah, yes, connecting with a partner. Some men ask me to dance. In a nightclub, I'd usually say no, if they're not my friends or my type. But somehow, here, it doesn't feel flirtatious or threatening. It feels safe, like I can let myself go. So I take a spin with a short, plump guy with blue hair. And even though I keep mistaking salsa steps for swing, the spontaneous joy of the dance keeps me smiling.
What's that running around in here? Up in Harlem, at a table for two.
After years dancing Lindy, Trish Richman says the feeling she gets here follows her outside Golden Gate Park. She says it's changed the way she sees San Francisco.
I think I continue to come every Sunday because it's connected me to the city. I never was in the park on a regular basis. I'm in the park all the time now. I see the city at play and at rest. I see families. I see people that are wandering by and they just start to dance. And it is an encouraging, spontaneous thing that happens every week. Some stay, some never dance again, but I feel connected to my community, to my physicality, and to my partner.
We all wish to feel that connection somewhere in our lives. Thousands of people find it every Sunday at a corner in Golden Gate Park. I found it simple by following the music and taking a simple step out of my comfort zone and onto the dance floor.
Bad at you cause your feet's too big. I really hate you cause your feet's too big. Your pedal extremities are obnoxious, yeah.
That story was told by Carolina Hidalgo. You've been listening to the Golden Gate Park cast. We're going to hang out for a while in this area. It's one of the most active in the park. The DeYoung Museum is right next door. The California Academy of Sciences is just across the way. And the sprawling music concourse is in between. Next time on the park cast, we'll stroll through this public space, past the spraying and bubbling fountains, to the majestic band shell at the southwest side. And we'll meet some of the players who perform Sundays in the summer as part of the historic Golden Gate Park Band.
In a lot of ways, we're like the, what do they call it, freeway philharmonic. You know, this gives some people a little bit of their salary, and then they go and play in that orchestra over there and get a little more, and that's how they survive.
Meet the musicians next time on the Golden Gate Park cast. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Julia Linus Goodman, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Victor Tense. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.